Good morning and welcome to the June 14, 2021 Commission meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District Board of Commissioners. This morning we're meeting in a study session. This afternoon we'll be meeting in a business session. Four commissioners are currently present, and I believe Commissioner Bowles will be on very shortly. The normal staff are in attendance at the meeting. Rebecca Garfine, Clerk of the Board, General Manager Steve Wright, and Eric Walquist, our General Counsel. Those were stated in order of importance to the meeting. Rebecca was first, so she appreciated that too. So anyway, due to the COVID virus, we're meeting remotely, and while normally I would remind everyone to silence their cell phones, the day that I asked that, yes, you remember to silence them, but remain on mute during the meeting unless you're speaking on a subject matter. It makes the meeting flow much better. We value public input at our meetings, and we'll be providing an opportunity for the public to have input in a couple of places at the end of our morning session and the end of our afternoon session. And if there's any member of the public in attendance today that wishes to speak to any item that is on our agenda, we'll provide an opportunity for you to request to be placed on the agenda in a few minutes. If you do wish to speak, we ask that you provide your name and address for the record, as our meetings are recorded and we wish to have an accurate record of your input. Our flag salute and safety minute will be brought to us today by Tiffany Davis.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, liberty and justice for all. Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm Tiffany Davis. I work in our Human Resources Department, and I've been with the district for about 3.5 years. Dave Parkhill from Safety asked me to share the Safety Minute this morning, and I was happy to do that. And although we had quite stormy weather yesterday, summer had been on my mind. So I thought this morning I would share a few tips about safety on the river. So this is a picture of my husband and my son. We love to be out, but that's part of what we love about living here in the valley is being out on our rivers and our lake, Lake Chelan. So three tips for you this morning. The first tip here is about knowing the flow. So here the river systems, as we all know from working here at the PUD, are dynamic. They change. The conditions may be one way in the morning, may be different later. And part of safety on the river is kind of knowing what you're getting into. So we're pretty lucky that if we're going out on the Columbia River or Lake Chelan, we can actually download the Current app, which I have on my phone. And my husband told me, I was asking him if he was aware of it. He's like, oh, I've had that on my phone for a while. So he uses it routinely. I am learning about it. But it's a really great way to get a sense of the conditions before you head out. It's got flow information, also information about temperature. You can go and check out the local boat launches, see what's open, what's not open, what the depths are like. And it also has some interesting information about fish counts, which you may not need for boating purposes, but you may find interesting if you're going to go out fishing. So that's a great tip, regardless of what you're doing out on the river, is to have a sense of what you're getting into for the day. And the app's a good way to do it, depending on where you're going. The next tip I would share is in regards to life jackets. So obviously for us, we have a little kid. It's really important for us to wear life jackets, not only for his safety, but for our own safety, but especially with kids. According to the Department of Health for Washington State, kids ages 1 to 17, drowning is the second leading cause of unintentional death. I think sometimes because we are in a nice area of Washington with good warm weather, we assume those deaths are happening in swimming pools, but that's actually not the case. In Washington State, most drowning deaths occur in open water. In a four-year period, again, this is from the Department of Health, from 1999 to 2003, 85% of youth drownings could have been prevented with an intervention such as a life jacket. So we really try to wear our life jacket. I'm a poor swimmer. My husband's a really strong swimmer, but it doesn't really matter. For our own safety and to set a good example for our son, we try to always have our life jacket on if we're out in the open water. So just a reminder that we hope that, you know, you'll do the same, set that good example as adults, that just because we can swim doesn't mean the danger is not maybe there for us, depending on the river conditions. And my last tip here is just about education. So in 2019 alone, $55 million worth of property damage was done in the U.S. as a result of recreational boating accidents. In Washington, most vessel operators are required to obtain a boater education card. A few years ago, I actually had to get my own boater's education card so that I could operate our jet ski, which is really fun, but I realized through taking the education that there was so much that I didn't know about the rules of the waterway, things you should be watching out for, the etiquette, all kinds of different rules. So it's a little scary when you realize how much you don't actually know, and that maybe you've been out and maybe it was not the safest thing. So in Washington, yeah, if you're going to operate even a jet ski, you need to go get your boater's education. It took me about 6 hours. Getting some general education is obviously really well worth it if you're going to spend time out on the water. In 2019, 70% of the 613 boating accident-related deaths that occurred in the United States involved a boat operator that hadn't received any boating education. So a few hours of coursework could potentially save a life. It's well worth doing, even if it feels like a hassle. If you're going to be out of the water, I would encourage you to go get that taken care of. So those are my three tips, quick and easy, hopefully easy to follow. Hopefully the sun comes back out for us and we can all get back out on the water. So thanks again for having me this morning.
Thank you, Tiffany. Great safety minute with a real positive presentation. I looked at that last picture and I thought, not at this point of my kids, but of my grandkids. And, you know, our kids are our most precious resource. If for no other reason to follow everything is to protect our kids and our grandkids. So thank you. Any other commissioner comments? Ann?
Oh, now I've got to go back. Sorry. There we go. Yeah, so just an add-on. That was a great presentation. Really important. Just a quick story. Two weekends ago, we were up at our cabin, which is about 18 miles up the lake. And we left to do something. Babysitter was there with my 12-year-old grandson and his friend, and they did have life jackets on. They went out in the canoe and decided they were going to canoe across the lake to Mitchell Creek. We don't have our boat in the water yet up there, and so they did. They didn't have any problems. However, the lake is so cold, if they had tipped in that canoe, it's a Grumman canoe and you can tip it over out in the middle of the lake, they would not be able to right that canoe and get back in it. And they would be stuck in the middle of the lake in that cold water, and I don't know how long you'd last. It's warmed up a little bit. So, yeah, life jackets critically important, but also be aware of how cold the lake is in the spring.
Yeah. Well, thank you, commissioners.
Thank you.
Any other comments, commissioners? Well, thanks again, Tiffany. Great, great safety minute.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you, Tiffany.
At this point, item 2 on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. And at this time, if there's any member of the public that wishes to address any items on our agenda, we would hear that request at this moment, and the commission could decide if we have additional input on any agenda item. Hearing none, management has suggested moving resolutions to consent, but there was a request from one commissioner to keep resolution 11 on the regular agenda. And so is there any objection to moving resolution number 12 to the consent agenda? Hearing none, I'll consider the, and if there's any other changes that need to happen to the agenda for the day, I'll hear requests at this time. Hearing none, our agenda will be approved with the moving of resolution number 12 to the consent agenda. For item 3, CPO winner recognition, I hand off to Steve Wright.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. So we had three different events that we wanted to talk about today. I'm going to do them one by one and then allow the folks who are our CPO winners to speak to the board and share their stories. The first one has to do with the crack repair. Recall that we had a crack in Pier 1 at Rock Island. That's pretty scary. We had a lot of engineering analysis that suggested it was not the kind of crack that created a significant exposure for the dam, but it was significant enough that we were limiting truck traffic on the deck of the dam, and we had really wanted to get this repaired in advance of the check-in for the Habitat Conservation Plan. This turned out to be a much bigger project than we anticipated. There is a fair amount of wiring that was embedded in the dam and actually had to be moved into conduits on the outside of the structure, and then a fair amount of work to actually do the repair itself. We were struggling some, candidly, with schedule. We were worried about whether we were going to be able to get this work done in advance of the HCP check-in and the spill season, which would have meant, again, limiting traffic on the deck as well. So we had a couple of folks just really step forward and do a fantastic job, Josh Mandoli and Brett Bickford, just decided that they were going to make sure this project got completed on time and put in the time and effort and the dedication to make sure that it did get completed. And so we, fortunately, the work was completed in advance of spill season. And so we're now in much better shape, and it's really as a result of their personal commitment and stepping to the plate. So I want to say thank you to them. I'm not sure we heard that Josh may not be able to join us today, but I think that Brett is on the line. Brett, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Great. Would love to have you share your story.
Yes, as Steve mentioned, the primary goal of this project was to repair a crack that was in the first pier at Spill Bay 1. That crack was formed after many years of the dam's thermal cycling, heating and expanding, as well as we have some concrete growth. And because it's at a corner, those forces caused a shear crack in one of those piers. So that large crack was repaired. It took many more months to do the electrical work than we thought it would. The contractor had quite struggled getting the manpower he needed to work. We had scheduled this work to be at night so that we minimized impact to operations. And the project was supposed to be done in January, but it extended all the way till mid-March before we could actually do the crack repair. And so it took a lot of effort on my part to work with the contractor, work with their subs to try to find resources, to be able to work through the winter at night. We had lots of problems with equipment and cold weather. And we were able to get it done. And Josh did an excellent job. The conduit and wire that ran through the dam affected all parts of our district operations, SCADA, security, power operations, transmission. And so he did an outstanding job of organizing, planning the work, helping all of our customers internally feel confident that we could make the cutovers, which is, you know, disconnecting a wire in one location and reconnecting it at another. And we were able to do that in pretty short order. And I believe all of the internal customers were very happy that that we were able to get that done. Our internal crews, our technicians and wiremen did all the cutover work. They did an outstanding job, worked really hard for several weeks to make sure all that could happen.
So, Brett, this is Commissioner Smith. You know, one of the things that I've always noticed about our engineers is they have a tendency to be understated in what they've accomplished. And this is a big thing. And we appreciate what you guys do, and you are so methodical and so oriented towards getting the job done, that I'm glad that we've given you the opportunity to celebrate a little bit on this one, because it's we have a lot of assets out there that we rely on and are very important to the overall health of the district. And you guys put a lot on your shoulders, and we appreciate it. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for the recognition and the kind words.
Yeah, thank you so much, Britt.
Any other comments?
I'd like to just chime in and say I'm really proud of you guys for being able to grab the bull by the horns, get the job done, and get it done so timely. It also takes creative thinking to accomplish what you guys have done. So sincere thank you from this commissioner.
Thank you very much.
And, all right, Steve.
Brett, I'm not sure if you can see it, but you're getting applause from the other commissioners, too. So.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Next up, we wanted to recognize Loretta Coonfield. So a few months ago, we had a goal to try to put in place a new reservation system for parks. We had last year, you may recall, we had so many people showing up. We had long lines of people for our first-come, first-served policy for overnight stays in our campgrounds. And we really wanted to try to do better in terms of serving customer owners and other folks who like to take advantage of our services. So we had worked to put in place a reservation system. Now, that reservation system requires that we take money, basically. People have to put financial commitments down in order to hold their reservations. And then sometimes they change their mind afterward, and so there are, we have to get the opportunity to give them their money back. There's a lot of accounting that goes into this, and we struggled in the early days of the reservation system of being able to take care of that accounting. Now, you all know that it is extremely important to our finance group to have a clean audit opinion and to keep track of all the flows of money that go on around here. So we needed somebody to really step to the plate and help solve these problems. Loretta Coonfield just did a marvelous job bringing together all the various folks that needed to be involved in this discussion, making sure that the money was going to the right place and going back to the right place when it needed to, and just generally taking care to make sure that, in fact, we were handling this consistent with the high standards that we have for financial accounting around here. And she did this in time that was her time off, including some vacation time, and just showed a real commitment to making sure the district succeeds. So we want to take a moment and say thank you to Loretta, and Loretta would love it if you would have anything you'd like to share with the board.
I think good morning, everyone. I think, I was just working with a team that was committed to doing it right, and I'm glad that I could help. It was a challenging process, but I think we've streamlined it now enough to be successful.
Spoken, this is Anne.
Yes.
Thank you, Loretta. Spoken with humility, as always, from Loretta. Thank you so much, Loretta. But next time on your vacation, turn off your phone, turn off your iPad, and take a vacation.
So, Loretta.
Well, you'll appreciate this. I was standing in an olive orchard taking a tour when I took the phone call. So it was, I was branching out seeing other orchard activities. But, yes, I'll try and turn off my phone.
Loretta, I looked at when I first looked at this, what we've done and the fact that we first went live and the first day received $100,000, upwards of $100,000. I thought, whoa, this had to be a challenge. I'm well aware as a consumer of making reservations at various places, how that reservation system for the state, and I think now the federal government gets challenged when you have your go live date. Probably the customers were coming in starting at midnight. It wouldn't surprise me because they wanted to do that. So it had to be a challenge, and I really appreciate your dedication. And I'm glad that the tour you're on was in an olive orchard. I mean, that's it's good to get back to our agricultural roots. So. You made my day when you even shared that.
Thank you, everyone.
Anybody else?
Randy, this is Steve McKenna. I just wanted to express my appreciation to Loretta and the team. I can tell you, as an RV owner, there is nothing more frustrating than to wait in line because there's not a system in place to put in a reservation, wait in line for hours, and then find out there's no chance of getting into the park. And it's, okay, not only have you spent your time, wasted your time, frustrated that the organization that's serving you can't figure out how to make this happen, it's one of those little things that really makes a big difference in people's lives, and yet there's not a whole lot of recognition when it's working well. Everybody just expects it to work well. So I wanted to let you know, I, for one, as a commissioner, really appreciate something that's working well, for the most part, goes undetected by our customers. And but I do recognize the efforts, and the benefit is just making life much better for those people that we're serving. So congratulations on a good job.
Thank you again.
As also a fellow camper, I'd like to comment, Loretta, this is a long time in coming for having an efficient registration system up at BB. And I know personally, I've been up there before when, fortunately, I've had a spot, but I've witnessed maybe as many as a half a dozen campers waiting outside the gate trying to wait for someone to leave so that they could get a spot. And as Commissioner McKenna said, that sort of ruins your vacation. It ruins your weekend. Not only have you just spent a lot of time waiting for something that didn't materialize, but you've lessened your chances you're going to find one somewhere else because now it's later in the day. So I applaud all your efforts. I think it's a great thing. I'm excited to hear more throughout the season and a summary at the end of this summer so that we can all get excited about the great success that you guys have had. So thank you.
Loretta, this is Dennis. When I take a look at the all the variables that you and your crew had to deal with to get the setup and make it functional and cover all those bases is truly an accomplishment and much appreciated. And it's only going to make our customers happier people. And that's kind of the name of the game. So thanks for your commitment, your willingness to do it, and the success in your efforts.
Thank you again. I just want to emphasize that mine was more on the accounting end. The Parks Department was responsible for all the implementation and the work to make this work. So I don't want to take credit where I didn't do the work. I was late to the game, and it was more on the accounting and the cash reconciliation of this project. But thank you for my work, and I think the Parks deserve the thank you on the rest of it.
And we'll pass along your comments to Ryan Baker and his team, who worked hard on this as well. Loretta, thank you very much. Our last CPO winners for today are a project which has been in front of the board, and I know you're familiar with, but I think it's worth reiterating the importance of this to the district. We have struggled for a while with the challenge of the quality of some of the equipment that we have received as we try to move towards investing in our assets, particularly in the hydropower assets that create such tremendous value around here, and had spoken widely around the idea that we needed to try to move the industry to improve the quality. And we felt the best way to do that was to have them have skin in the game. And the way to do that is to have some form of warranty. This is a creative thought. It's a big thought. It's different from the way the industry operates. It took a tremendous amount of analytical work to think through just what is the value to the district's customer owners of an extended warranty, how much would we be willing to pay for that. Very impressive team, John Sagesser, John Yale, Mark Mullins, Peter Vanney, and Kirk Carlson, that put in I don't know how many hours trying to figure out what that value is and then negotiating an agreement with General Electric that we feel is helping us to achieve the best value for the most people for the longest period of time. So we're very proud of them and excited that they're able to join us today, and would like to give them a moment to speak as well and share their story with the board.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Segesser. I do just want to say thank you for the opportunity to work on something like this. It's really been an honor. I've had a long career here in the utility industry and marked several firsts in my career this year. This is one of them. It's a very unique, very special agreement, and just can't say enough about John and Mark and Peter and Kurt and their creativity, their tenacity to kind of stick with the process, keep coming after it day after day, night after night, coming up with new and creative ways to evaluate the financial benefits of this long-term agreement. I'd also like to really say thank you to GE, because they did the same way. They stuck with us throughout the process. They engaged throughout and really never gave up, continued on through the end.
This is John Yale. So I'll echo a lot of what John said, which makes it easier, but it's really fun to work on something that's never been done before. It challenges us. It makes us come up with really strange ideas that we shoot down for each other in lots of good conversations. But it is really fun to work on something that hasn't been done with a really great team like this. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Kurt. And thank you, Commissioners, for the opportunity to talk about this. From my perspective, I echo also what John and John have said, including in my life, I talk about difficult projects, interesting projects. The word in my family I use is chewy. They're chewy projects. This is one of the chewier projects that I've worked on from an economic point of view. Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Thanks, everybody. Go ahead, Mark.
Yep, go ahead, Peter.
All right. Thanks, everybody. I just wanted to... It was very interesting to work on, and I appreciated working with such a good team, and got a lot of diverse opinions and takes on a chewy topic.
Good morning, Commissioners. Thank you very much for the recognition. This has really been one of those projects that we'll look back on for many, many years, particularly with a successful outcome. But it was challenging, and I've heard the word creativity come up many times. There was a very iterative process starting several years ago as to how we are going to value this extended warranty. Coming up with a methodology was certainly not easy, but it was really starting with a blank piece of paper and working from there. So folks like John Yale and Kurt Carlson and Peter Banny bringing their disciplines to the table with asset management and economics and finance and statistical analysis and the iterative process that they went through, working tirelessly, many late nights and early mornings to make this successful. So I appreciate their work and thank you for that. And the work really goes beyond just the five of us getting recognized today, because it was a large team of engineers that were supporting John, some other folks with in finance and risk as well. So it was really a big team effort that there's a lot of people that need to be recognized here today. I'd also like to recognize John Segesser for his expertise and his leadership at the negotiation table. I had an opportunity to participate with him and had many moments of, wow, that was impressive. John just did a great job of delivering the message from our executive management team of really what our objectives were, conveying the work that was done by John and Kurt and Peter and others to validate this product in terms of, are we getting a good product for a good value? And the analysis indicated that we did. So we were really, really proud of that. And of course, John being able to deliver that collaboratively negotiate with GE and then turn that into a contract was really impressive. So Thanks to all, and thanks, commissioners, for your recognition, and to the senior team as well, with Kelly and support, also, Kelly and Kirk also providing their support on prioritization. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, to the five of you, I just want to say I thought about a lot of things as you've been talking of, in my past about projects where there was an inspiration at a moment in time, and then there was a lot of perspiration after that time that you guys put together. Good projects, sometimes they say 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration, and you've delivered on both. And I quite honestly think that the template that you have created can hold great prospects for us doing this again in another arena, and it won't be quite so new next time. And I'm excited for what you've done for our utility as a team to see another way of doing business. This is exciting. Commissioners? Yes. Thank you so much.
Randy, I just, not to belabor the compliments, but, you know, what I really appreciate and what I get excited about as a commissioner, as an owner of the organization as well as a ratepayer, is our folks had an impact on the industry for continuous improvement that, you know, our desire to have some better quality, a better quality product that we're using, really push the industry to improve their quality, and for the benefit of everybody. So I think that's a big deal. And you know, not only benefited us, but benefited the industry as a whole, and benefited the GE, the company that's producing a better piece of equipment. I think it's those type of things that when we push each other for continuous improvement, for excellence, it really benefits everybody in the long run. So congratulations to everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, commissioners.
Commissioners, it's unusual for us to bring forward three CPO winners. I think it's the first time we've done it, as a matter of fact, and hopefully you can see now why we did. These were three excellent examples of people taking personal ownership to go solve problems to create best value for the most people for the longest period of time. So we are appreciative of them. And hope you don't mind that we took a little more time than usual, because we think these were deserving awardees. And that comes from the entire senior management team.
I know I don't mind. This was a really good CPO session. Thank you.
All right, commissioners, we are ready to move to our next agenda item and say thank you to our CPO awardees for joining us today. Next agenda item is we have Aline Underwood up to talk about the quarterly fish and wildlife update.
Hi, good morning, commissioners. I'm Aline Underwood, manager of Fish and Wildlife, and with me today is also Lance Keller and Catherine Willard. Three CPO winners is a hard act to follow, but we will do our darndest in what we can for updating you on some fish and wildlife. Actually, just today, fisheries program update. So why we're here today is Lance Keller is going to give a very brief update on our Rock Island Survival Study update. We're also, I'm going to give an update on our Habitat Conservation Plan implementation. So every year around this time, we complete annual reports that we submit to FERC that has an accounting of all of the work that we've done through our HCPs. We thought that would be a great opportunity and timing to share with you. And then finally, Catherine Willard is going to update you on some interesting ocean conditions and their effects on salmon and steelhead. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lance, and he can update you on our Rock Island Survival Study.
Great. Thanks, Elaine. Good morning, all. Lance Keller, Senior Fisheries Biologist with the district. First couple slides here are related to the survival study. As Elaine mentioned, this topic we've had in front of the Board of Commissioners a little bit. I am happy to notify you today that we've actually completed all the field work associated with the 2021 Rock Island HCP Confirmation Survival Study. The collection, transportation of study fish, the marking of those fish, and actually the release of those study fish were completed on May 22nd, and the first release was conducted on April 23rd. Collectively, amongst 15 replicates, we released just shy of 1,000 marked yearling Chinook with acoustic tags. Some initial travel time information that we received from a download of our receivers about two-thirds of the way through the study showed that we are seeing a wide range of travel times from the Rocky Reach Tailrace to the face of Rock Island Dam, albeit it is averaging about 16 hours for those fish to make their way down to Rock Island Dam. But we had some fish move as quickly as 7.5 hours, and some took as long as 209 hours. Looking down at the next box, this does explain some of the variability we do see in those travel times. We saw a decent wide range of flows during the study period, flows as little as 35 kcfs all the way up to 180.6 kcfs. Looking at the average across the study period, though, we're averaging about 126 kcfs. And in the HCP, we actually do have a flow requirement that we have to study under. And I am happy to report that this does meet the flow needed for a valid survival study. On top of that, we did provide our target spill of 10% of the daily average river flow for the study period. So those will be valid as well. Next slide, Rebecca. Thank you. So real briefly, next steps. We're expecting our preliminary results to be available in August. It does take a while to process all of this data. Each receiver has been collecting data up to this point. We're actually removing the receivers now as I speak. And they do pick up some background noise that comes in as false tag detection. So we have to filter all that data. Each receiver we're expecting those receivers to log over 1 million data points each. So it's a very large data set to chew through. So we have to pare that down to the actual tags that were released. In August, we will actually hand our data set over to Dr. John Skalski with the University of Washington, and he will conduct the statistical calculations and corrections if warranted. And then we'll have those results available in September to present to the HCP Coordinating Committee. On the heels of this study, we are already talking about our Rocky Reach Confirmation Study that's scheduled for 2022. We're going to begin the contract development in July and expected to bring that to the Board of Commissioners for their approval in September. With a not to exceed estimated somewhere between $1 to $1.5 million. We're still determining the level of resolution we will need for tag detection at Rocky Reach in 2022. So that's the reason we have a bit of a range there that we're expecting. And with that, I will turn it back over to Elaine Underwood.
Great, Lance. Thank you for that update. So now I wanted to switch gears and talk a little bit about some updates for what we've been doing the last year in implementing other components of our HCP. So this is a really great graphic that Grant County PUD provided. It's a little bit different way of thinking about what we do under our HCP, but it's a really great refresher. So on the one hand, at this balanced scale, we've got our fish loss, we've got hydropower development operation, and we've got all these predators eating the fish. And on the other side, we've got our fish mitigation. These are the tenets of our HCP. We preserve and restore habitat. We produce fish and hatcheries using best available fish science. We monitor projects or fish passage through our projects, like Lance just talked about. And we also have really extensive predator management programs. So I want to go ahead and just briefly talk about some of the Habitat Conservation Plan Tributary Committee funded projects in 2020. to go to the next slide, Rebecca. Thank you. So this is just a snapshot of some of the projects that the Tributary Committee funded in 2020. You can see the project names, a given location. Primarily, these are all within the Wenatchee River, although we have the opportunity to spend money from our Rocky Reach account and our Rock Island account anywhere from the Wenatchee River, frankly, all the way up to Chief Joseph. So you can see the total project total for the projects that were implemented was about $2.7 million. Our requested funding and what the TRIPCOM initially or ended up contributing is about close to half of that at about $1 million. So we do ask that other project applicants use some of their own funds. They use our funds to leverage additional funding entities. And so these are some of the projects that we did. I would also like to say that the balance on some of our project funds are, let's see, we have a Rock Island Project Species Plan account, and this is basically every year the money for each of the Rock Island and Rocky Reach HCPs is put into a fund. So for Rock Island, the account balance ending in 2020 was about $6.9 million. The plan species account balance for Rocky Reach was about $3.5 million. And what this means is this is a lot of money that all sorts of applicants can ask the Tributary Committee to fund their projects. So this is part of how we mitigate for some of the unintended consequences of our hydro power. Next slide, Rebecca, please. So here, I've talked a little bit, or I've shown you the releases for our HCP hatchery program. These are hatchery releases. So there's actually two slides here. The first slide are those programs that we own the hatchery facilities, we contract with WFW to operate them. And then in the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about our funding programs. So the most important thing to note here is we talk about the species, we have production level objectives. So you'll notice the time frame here is 2014 to 2023. Those are release years. So every 10 years under the HCP, we have the ability to recalculate what our 7% of hatchery production looks like. So under this recalculation that we did for those particular release years, those are our production levels. And we're actually currently just starting the process of going through our next 10-year recalculation, which is based on varying adult returns. And we will essentially look at what number of smolts we have to produce to make up for that up to 7% hatchery production. And the other important thing to note is you will see some discrepancies between our production level objectives and the total releases. And this is based in part on things like fish productivity, when we get the fish in, all sorts of things like that. And we do have in our permits the ability to release over 10% as well as less than 10% of our desired production level objective. Also really important to note for this and the next slide, which shows funding programs, that the HCP requires us to provide funding and capacity to reach these production level objectives. Why that's important is the district can't control things like how many fish come back, how productive the fish actually are. So this allows us some certainty in that as long as we provide the capacity and funding to produce those fish, we do get our NNI credit for hatchery production met. So on the next slide, this actually depicts some of our funding programs. So these are programs where we have a pretty healthy negotiation about what percent of someone else's hatchery production we should contribute to based on our objectives. So in this particular instance, we've got the Penticton hatchery, the Penticton sockeye hatchery with the Okanagan Nation Alliance. We also contribute to the Chief Joseph hatchery through the Colville tribe, as well as use our Similkameen acclimation facility. And we contribute to the Yakama Nation Coho program, which releases various fish in the Wenatchee and Mattow basins. So again, you can see their production level objectives for 14 through 23. The total releases in 2020 obviously vary. Some important things to note is, in particular case for sockeye, that's actually 218,000 fry, because that is a fry program. We have a broader conversion, or more robust conversion that we look at for smolts, and we also get credit for those fish that are naturally produced in the system as part of this reintroduction program. And then the last thing I'll note is for the summer Chinook, both the subyearlings and the smolts at Chief Joseph Hatchery, you will notice that the total releases in 2020 are far less than the production level objective. That was due to a catastrophic chiller failure that the Colvilles had at their Chief Joe Hatchery that has since been remedied. But again, as long as we have these agreements in place and we are providing the production or the funding and capacity, we do receive our full credit for NNI. So that's all I had for the snapshot of what we've been up to for the last year. Now we'll go ahead and turn it over to Catherine, who's going to talk a little bit about salmon and steelhead survival.
Aline, may I jump in here?
This is Anne. Yes, please.
So you said it was due to a chilling effect or lack of chilling effect that caused the drastic decrease in numbers?
Yes, actually it was a chiller failure. So the water in the tree, it needs to be chilled in order to make sure that the fish, the eggs and the sperm don't go bad or fish are preserved, mm-hmm. and so that chiller actually failed, so they weren't able to keep a lot of fish on station, and the fish were diseased, and the eggs didn't turn out well.
Ouch, that's tough.
Yes.
Wow. So do we, and we know for sure that they have a new chiller. Did they not have one on site? I mean, that's a serious issue.
Yes, it is, and they did have a chiller. It had a catastrophic breakdown, which sometimes in these types of things can happen. Luckily, they are funded, their capital investment is funded by Bonneville, and so they made a case to Bonneville to go ahead and have that chiller fixed. It has been fixed, and they have I think they bought a brand new chiller because they needed additional capacity as well. So we anticipate that will not happen again in the future. But, you know, these are the kinds of things that when we contemplated the HCP, why it was so important that we got credit for funding and capacity, because these types of catastrophic failures can happen just as accidents. So the most important thing is we still get credit for providing that money for that agreement.
Yeah, and just so one other quick question. You said that, so as long as we provide the funding and the capacity, then we can meet our objectives. But so when you say provide the capacity, exactly what do you mean by that?
That's a good question. So what that ultimately means is hatchery capacity. So we provide the tanks to rear the ponds. We provide the water in order to rear the fish. We provide all things in the hatchery environment, good aquaculturists that are needed to produce those fish. That's what we mean by capacity.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good report. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right, go ahead, Catherine.
All right, good morning. During our last Fish and Wildlife quarterly update, there had been a question asking what are the different factors that affect survival of salmon and steelhead. And freshwater survival is what we're most familiar with, and it's often boiled down to the four H's: hydropower, hatcheries, habitat, and harvest. The district achieved no net impact on freshwater survival through implementation of the HCPs, which focuses on the three of the four H's, as Aline and Lance just summarized. This includes achieving a standard of survival for fish that pass through our projects, operating hatchery programs that mimic the fitness of wild fish to minimize potential negative effects of the hatchery rearing environment, as I described during our last quarterly update, I'm sure you recall, and funding habitat improvement projects through the tributary fund to increase survival of salmon and steelhead during their freshwater rearing. Recent publications, however, from Dr. David Welch of Kentama Research Services in British Columbia and Dr. Brian Burke of NOAA Fisheries highlighted the effects that ocean conditions can have on salmon and steelhead, and that's what I'm going to focus on. Next slide, please. The recent study by Dr. David Welch shows that all stocks of Chinook salmon are declining along the West Coast at about the same rate, and concludes that habitat and dams are not the likely culprits. It's something far more out of our control, the ocean. So most of the West Coast rivers do not have dams, yet the percentage of decline of the Chinook population in those rivers is similar to the Snake River Chinook populations, where four dams have been thought to be the cause of the declines in wild Snake River Chinook salmon, which I'm sure you've seen in the news. The same can be said for wild steelhead, coho, and sockeye salmon returning to West Coast rivers. Their populations are also showing these similar declines, even in rivers that aren't dammed. Just to note, the Independent Science and Advisory Board, a collection of scientists under the Northwest Power Planning Council, is currently reviewing the paper to evaluate the accuracy of the paper and the conclusions. The NOAA Fisheries paper, authored by Brian Burke, modeled wild populations of Snake River Basin Chinook during the ocean phase of their life under various climate warming scenarios. Just a little more than a 1 degree Celsius temperature increase in sea surface temperature produced dire effects for salmon. Based on the results of the model, even if freshwater survival in the river was 100%, because of these warming ocean conditions, salmon and steelhead populations will not recover, the model predicted. It's important to note, however, the Burke paper only used one parameter, temperature, to conduct their modeling exercises, and even within NOAA, there are some different viewpoints about how dire things are with regard to ocean conditions. Next slide, please. So what has changed in the ocean that has negatively affected salmon and steelhead survival? Essentially, it comes down to climate change, which is driving an increase in surface water temperatures of the ocean over the long term. Scientists characterize the sea surface temperatures as either in a cool phase or a warm phase. Cool phases are beneficial to salmon and steelhead. For example, cool phases bring the northern ocean variety of copepods, which is a zooplankton, which are nutritious food for salmon and steelhead, south to the waters off the Washington and Oregon coast where the salmon feed on them. This slide is a graphical display of an index which measures marine heat waves. Marine heat waves are expected to become more frequent and last longer in the future, which is demonstrated in this graph. A recent big marine heat wave, which I'm sure you've heard of, which lasted from 2014 through 2016 and was devastating for cold water species in the ocean, was called, nicknamed the Blob, because it had this appearance of an angry red mass on maps that showed ocean water temperatures. Salmon and steelhead returns responded negatively to the effects of the Blob, which was seen in the lowest returns of salmon and steelhead in 2018 and 2019. Good news is the ocean is currently in a cool phase. An article actually came out in the Seattle Times this morning stating that researchers from Oregon State University have found that plankton populations are responding positively to this cool phase, which could be good news for salmon and steelhead populations, at least in the short term. But of course, it's too early to say. Next slide, please. The Federal Columbia River Power System BiOp that was issued in 2020 evaluated the effects of the operation and maintenance of 14 federally operated hydropower projects. The analysis included using a life cycle model to project estimates of population abundance and extinction risk to endangered Middle Fork Salmon River salmon populations. This graph shows the results for the Middle Fork Salmon River populations, and it found relative resilience in the freshwater stages of the salmon life history, as indicated by the blue, yellow, and orange bars on the graph. Rising sea surface temperatures were found to be the dominant driver of survival. It reduced abundance and productivity at the ocean life stage for this population of salmon, as indicated by the red bars on the right side of the graph. The model results concluded that rising sea surface temperatures pose the biggest threat to spring, summer, Chinook salmon populations. So next slide, please. So what are the biological responses of fish to these warmer ocean temperatures? At the fish scale, there's a disruption in their normal body function, so it reduces the fish size, so they're not able to survive as well. Additionally, warmer water can reduce the overall production in the food web, making it more difficult for fish to find suitable prey, resulting in smaller, less fat salmon and steelhead that do not survive as well. And then there's also a shift in predators. For example, there was a dramatic increase of adult California sea lions that moved into the Columbia River beginning in 2015 as a result of that blob, which increased, these sea lions increased predation on both adult and juvenile salmon. I want to point out that there are two caveats associated with the modeled negative effects of warming ocean on salmon and steelhead survival. So one, Pacific sea surface water temperatures may not warm at the rate predicted. And two, there is a possibility that the Northeast Pacific Ocean does not warm as what is modeled to happen. And perhaps some ecological surprise will reverse the historical relationship between rising sea surface temperatures and salmon survival. Ecological surprises could include shifts to a different prey species by salmon, or perhaps predators of salmon will shift to a different prey source that was not available under these colder water temperatures. We honestly don't know 100% what will happen. In summary, though, the actions the district are taking through implementation of our HTPs, particularly optimization of our hatchery programs and investing in habitat, will improve freshwater survival, at least at the local scale. The negative effects to salmon populations modeled by warming ocean conditions are indeed not good. However, without the actions being taken at the freshwater phase to improve freshwater survival, it is likely salmon steelhead populations would not have a chance of recovery and could be worse off than they currently are. Next slide, please. And with that, if there are any questions or comments, we'd be happy to answer.
Commissioners, questions or comments?
Yeah, I'd like to comment. It's a frustration for me. I watch, as an example, the investigative reporting on King 5, and lately they've been highlighting, featuring the high head dams on Wiscagget, and focusing blame on the reduction of fish in Puget Sound, primarily related to the dams. Which seems to me to be a fairly easy and obvious target. The change of 1 degree in temperature is pretty subtle in terms of, and it's not very exotic in terms of coverage, but the factors affecting the overall condition and survivability of the fish, it seems to me to be certainly affected more at the ocean level than it is at the Skagit River level. And then when I start taking a look at the overall size of population in the greater Seattle-Tacoma area, and I look at the number of vehicles who daily chew their tires off, and the residual rubber that gets washed into Puget Sound, as well as dripping oil from vehicles. I look at the population of people who, approximately 50,000 people in Seattle, Tacoma, don't have adequate sanitary conditions, and that becomes wastewater directly through the drainage systems into Puget Sound and into the ocean. That's one side of the picture. The other side, when I look at how diligent, as an example, Schlan, Grant, and Douglas County are, as well as Bonneville and other agencies, in rearing healthy fish. If it wasn't for the hydro production, where would the fish population be? So we seem to be willing to really focus on one area, societally as a problem, and condemn an area that is probably maybe the most responsible in maintaining what runs we do have. And so it's all I'm doing is expressing one commissioner's frustration with the public perception that we're the bad guys. And honestly, anyway, thanks for the report. you scratched my itch, and I appreciate it. And it's just really interesting in discussions that I have for people just to say, oh, I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so thank you so much for allowing me to have some updated information and to be able to articulate a different perspective. Well, thanks. I appreciate it greatly. And thanks for listening to me.
Anytime. I feel your pain.
Yeah. Well, and you know you've got my support, so keep doing what you're doing and doing it well. Thank you.
Any other comments from commissioners or questions? The question that emerges in my mind that we didn't talk about at all, and it's not our charge to do that, is, you know, you've got the 4-H's. We did harvest is still out there. It's, you know, I mean, well, I'll say ditto to what Dennis said, and say that the picture is so much more complex than what our media wants to portray it. They want to have a feel-good story where we can make a difference by removing a dam or forcing fish passage. It's a hard equation.
It is.
Any other commissioner comments or questions? Great report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, commissioners. And by the way, that last report on ocean conditions is a response to a request that had been in our parking lot. I think it might have been Commissioner Congdon a while back that made that request. So we're going to pull that one out of our parking lot and consider that one finished, at least for now. I'm sure we'll be coming back to it over time, though. Next up, we want to bring back Ron Gibbs to talk about the 2021 to 2022 insurance program renewal.
Steve, good morning.
I'm sorry.
Ron, excuse me. Before we go on to Ron, back to Arlene and Catherine. I know on that last study on the ocean, there's going to be some challenges to those articles. Could we ask them that if there's any follow up to the NOAA study or the University of Washington study, that they come back to that, either confirming or challenging those facts? I would like to kind of keep up with that if I could.
Yes, absolutely. We could. We'll definitely keep you in the loop.
Great. Thank you. Sorry, Ron.
Oh, no problem. well, I was just going to say good morning, commissioners. Ron Gibbs, insurance and claims manager. I'm not seeing the presentation yet. Thank you. Again, just here to talk about the district's insurance program. And Rebecca, if you could please move on to slide 2, I'd appreciate it. So it's the time again for the annual renewal of the district's insurance program, and that'll be completed on July 1st. The premiums that I'm going to be sharing today are based on a combination of quotes we've received, as well as our best estimates for the policies that have not yet been quoted. We'll continue to get additional quotes and negotiate all the way up through the July 1st renewal. Similar to years past, we will be requesting your authorization for the insurance program renewal with a motion with an up to amount this year of $4,275,000. That'll be at the end of the presentation. Slide 3, please. So our efforts today are all about to obtain the best insurance available for the best pricing available, and that supports the district value of stewardship by protecting public resources, managing risks, and controlling costs. Slide 4. So as we've been sharing over the last couple of years, the worldwide insurance markets remain challenging, especially for utilities. Globally, the insurance markets remain in what is termed hard market. That's, of course, caused by an imbalance between supply and demand for commercial insurance. And the hard market this year is resulting in higher premiums in virtually all types of insurance. Utilities are particularly affected due to the losses trending upwards for both mechanical breakdowns and power plants, and then also as for increased claims and liability. Jury awards are getting very, very high. They're accelerating rapidly. For utilities in the West, wildfire is adding an additional pressure on premiums and insurance availability. We've all seen the news articles reporting on utilities and wildfire, and certainly insurance markets are reacting to wildfire risk. We are fortunate that our dams are located in areas not very susceptible to wildfire risk, and so that is less of a concern for our property underwriters. Based on what we are hearing from brokers and colleagues, the general range for property insurance increases for utilities is in the 15 to 25% range this year. For the liability insurance policies, this year the markets have significantly changed for utilities in the West and present the biggest challenge for us. Following the Labor Day fires last fall, insurance companies became convinced that wildfire risk has dramatically increased for utilities in the entire Western United States. Three of our current eight liability insurance carriers are choosing to no longer insure utilities in the West. So we're going to have to replace $50 million of the $150 million in limits that we purchase. Insurance companies that are still willing to cover utilities in the West are dramatically increasing their premiums, and we are seeing some of that in our quotes. Slide five, please. So when speaking with other utilities in the region, we learned some insurance companies are quoting over 100% increases for their premiums. I've been told by a broker that early indications from some of our underwriters are near that 100% level as well, and there just simply aren't other options available. So due to the timing of the board meeting this year, we still not received all of the quotes on the program. So some of the information that I'll be sharing, again, is going to be based on estimates. And you might recall that in years past, we had to seek authority from the board relying on estimates in part. So this is not new for us. I do want to switch gears a little bit and talk about our insurance broker. We were recently forced to make a change with our broker. Our previous broker of 16 years was laid off in May following a merger between Wells Fargo Insurance and USI Insurance. And the remaining brokers in the office had no background insuring power utilities. So since this is obviously such a critical year, we felt like the best thing for the district would be to find another brokerage firm and one that has experience we need in terms of working with power underwriters. So with the support of Kelly and Mark Mullins, we quickly chose a new broker company, McGriff Insurance Services. Next slide, please. I think we're still waiting for the next slide. Okay, thank you. McGriff specializes in brokering for the power utility business, and they currently have a 30% market share. Oh, I think we skipped ahead, sorry. Slide six, please. But I'll just share that some of the clients in our region that McGriff has are Avista and Bonneville Power, and they also broker for Southern Companies and Tennessee Valley Authority, and many other very well-known utilities. So they've got a great reputation, and they come highly recommended, and I think they give us really the best shot at delivering a successful insurance program renewal this year. So far, I've been very impressed with how they've handled the transition. They'll continue to partner with us in negotiations all the way up to the July 1st renewal. Slide seven, please. In my meetings with the property insurance underwriters, the Rock Island warranty information was very well received, and I think will certainly have an impact on our premium savings over time, but also really helped me support my theme in the presentation that we are trying to achieve the best for the most for the longest. So it was a really positive message I could share that, again, was very well received. There's also a lot of interest in the work that we're doing with HRI. Probably our most important insurance company that we work with, Aegis, they requested that John Yale and I meet with them last week to discuss HRI. And the result of that was that Aegis is very likely to promote membership in HRI to other utilities that they insure. So we're excited about that. They insure virtually every major power utility in the United States. So I think it'll bring some really good visibility to HRI, which helps everybody in the hydro industry, I think. In my presentation to liability underwriters this year, my focus was on making the case for shoreline PUD based on all the hard work that we've done to address our wildfire exposure. So I prepared a very detailed presentation for underwriters where we outlined all of our major wildfire mitigation efforts. So what they expressed in the meetings with them that committing to a higher vegetation management standard was really impactful for them. And so is the power shutoff program that we're developing. And I won't go into detail about all the other mitigations that we discussed, but I did receive very good feedback from underwriters, including that we really stand out among our peers. So I truly believe our mitigation efforts will give us a good shot with some insurance companies that might otherwise have been on the fence about covering us. And we'll know for sure, of course, as quotes arrive. But I also do know that wildfire mitigation work is having an immediate impact on our premiums. Following our meeting with Aegis on the liability side, they reduced their quote by $75,000. They had given us a wildfire surcharge, and they said that the reduction was specifically due to the wildfire mitigation work that we're doing. So they insure the first $35 million of our liability program, and all the layers of insurance that line up above them. I mentioned we have 8 different insurance companies. They queue off of the Aegis quote, so that $75,000 reduction should have a ripple effect all the way up through the entire program. And yes, you did hear me correctly. We did. You did hear wildfire surcharges. Aegis came up with this new concept for all utilities that they insure west of the Mississippi. They just apply a surcharge for a wildfire risk, and there's 4 different levels that they choose. We're on the lowest level, by the way. So just to finish up this slide, I just want to emphasize that the wildfire mitigation work we are doing will help us both in our efforts to maintain our current insurance limits, but also should help us with liability premiums as well. Slide 8, please. So the numbers that are arriving now in the property renewal indicate that we are likely to see about a 15% increase for the year for an estimated premium of $1,920,000. And this is a little better than the 28% increase we got last year, but clearly the hard market conditions continue to impact premiums. Slide 9, please. So this year we can really see the impact of the wildfire risk and what it's having on our liability premiums. As quotes have come in, the numbers do point to a substantial increase. I'm estimating currently about a 56% increase. So that would bring our premiums up to $1,960,000. And all indications are that we are witnessing a permanent shift by the insurance companies, really, in terms of their approach to underwriting utilities in the West. I believe we can expect to pay much more for our wildfire risk going forward than we have historically. I don't expect the insurance perceptions to change in the foreseeable future. If wildfires worsen in the coming years, the insurance markets will continue to react, and they'll have higher premiums and also could potentially reduce coverage availability. I will say, though, the silver lining is that the good work the district is doing on our wildfire mitigations has positioned us to obtain the best insurance premiums possible. Slide 10. This chart gives a visual of sort of where we've been over the last, I think we've got about 12 years in here. The property premiums are shown in blue, and then the liability is shown in brown. And I just wanted to point out, you might notice that the property premiums historically have always been greater than the liability. This is the first year in my time at the district that the liability premiums are now greater than the property premiums. So I expect that continue to be the case going forward, just for all the reasons we've just discussed. Slide 11, please. This summary gives an overview of all the changes to our renewal premiums. If my estimates hold true, we should be looking at an increase of about $1 million, which would be a 32% increase over what we paid in 2020. In our budgeting and business planning efforts, we've communicated that we anticipated some large increases due to wildfire risk and market conditions. That said, this result would be 8.5% over budget, primarily because the reaction by insurance companies to the Labor Day fires was unprecedented. We've never seen anything like 56% increase on a liability program. So we did budget some large increases, but their reaction was pretty extraordinary. Slide 12. So you can see that the proposed motion is seeking authority that is $250,000 higher than our current estimated cost for the renewal. So So similar to what we've done previously, we've added a contingency just in case we get some surprises with the remaining quotes that we've yet to receive. I'm optimistic that we will not need to use the contingency, but we felt like it would be prudent given the major changes that we're seeing in the insurance markets this year. Slide 13. So for the next steps, I would just ask the board to expect insurance markets to remain challenging going forward in terms of premium and coverage, especially on the liability side. I think market conditions could change for property in coming years that gives us some relief, but the liability side I expect to remain challenging. The insurance companies view our wildfire risk, or their view on our wildfire risk will likely continue to drive pricing on our liability policies. And I can assure you that we are going to continue to fight hard for the best premiums and coverage available so we can avoid using the contingency if at all possible. But I feel like we have our A-team working for us with the new broker, McGriff, and we'll be negotiating all the way up through the July 1st renewal date. And then we will return in July for an update to the board on the final results of our negotiations. Are there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions? So Ron and I were talking a little bit before the meeting, and I once again thanked him for the positive outlook that he always brings to his presentation, and this had to be a challenging one for him. One thing that I picked up on, Ron, that I hesitate to even ask the question, if we hadn't been classified in the lowest risk for wildfire, where our premiums might have gone. Because, you know, and that's an accomplishment on our entire staff's part for us to be there in Chelan County, which is rated as one of the highest risk counties in maybe it is the highest risk of wildfire in the state of Washington. So, you know, there's positives there that we can look at. So I thank you for that presentation.
Sure. Yeah, I can tell you that the highest risk utilities are receiving $1 million wildfire risk surcharge that will be spread out over the next three renewals. And we were selected to have a $350,000 tier. And the first quote that we received gave us a $200,000 quote for the first stage and getting us to that $350,000, and they dropped that down to $125,000. So our goal, and I've already talked to our broker, he thinks that we've got a good shot of getting them to reduce the ultimate wildfire surcharge down below the $350,000, just based on the feedback we received from them. They're very complimentary about the work that we're doing on the wildfire risk. And that was the reason they dropped it down this year. So I'm hopeful that in the coming years, we never get to that $350,000 level, but of course, time will tell.
Thank you. Any other questions from commissioners? We are being requested to adopt a motion to provide the authority for the district to finalize their insurance. Everybody should have a copy of that motion in front of them if somebody wishes to make that motion.
I can make the motion. I propose a motion to authorize the district to provide expenditures not to exceed $4,275,000 plus surplus lines, taxes, and fees for the purchase of district insurance for July 1, 2021 through 22 policies upon terms and conditions approved by the general manager.
Motion has been made. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you very much, commissioners. I appreciate your support.
Thank you for what you do for our district, Ron. We appreciate all the effort you put in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, commissioners, we want to give you an update on the fire safety outage management plan. We continue to do a lot of outreach in the Lake Wenatchee and Plain communities. Rachel Hansen, Jenna Rahm, Tika Sellers, and Chad Bowman will be making this presentation.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Rachel Hansen. Let's just move to slide 2, if you don't mind. What we're going to do today is I'll give you an update on the work we're doing with our community partners to better understand the impacts if we ever have to use this fire safety outage. We'll share with you feedback that we've learned in our outreach. And in a broader context, we have a few interesting developments to share with you with regard to utilities and wildfire. And lastly, let's talk about where we go from here. Next slide. So just for review, we're moving into the last stage of developing the Fire Safety Outage Management Plan. Since last fall, we've compared best practices, we developed a plan, we worked with our public safety partners to further develop that plan, and for the last month, we've been working on mitigation strategies and public outreach. Next slide. So these are the subcommittees we formed to better understand and possibly mitigate some of the impacts if we ever had to use a fire safety outage. And if this list seems shorter, it's because we combined a couple of the committees where it made sense to do so. So talking about our first committee, next slide, please. Jenna Rahm will be talking about telecom and radio communications.
Hi, good morning, Commissioners. Just a quick update on the work we've been doing with our telecoms, radio, internet service providers. This committee, I guess we're calling it, is moving a little bit slower than the others, only because for the most part, we've been meeting with all of these entities individually at their request. So we have been able to meet with all of the major national cellular carriers, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile. We're also working through meeting with all the internet service providers in the area. And eventually we'll be also working with the agency EMS divisions that have radio communications in the area. The main purpose of this group is to identify who has services in this phase one area and what type of services or facilities they have in that area. Assess their backup power capabilities or emergency capabilities in the event of a power shutoff, and then establish a point of contact and communication protocol for that entity in the event that we foresee a fire safety outage on the horizon. We can get in touch with them quickly and work through our mitigation strategies. Then once we get into an event, the main purpose of this group is just to serve as a liaison with all of these stakeholders in telecoms and radio and assist with any emergent needs as they come up during the outage. And then just documenting lessons learned once we've been through this and coming up with continuous improvement ideas. Any questions about this group?
Great, thanks, Jenna. So the next slide, I'm gonna cover vulnerable populations. This group met over 4 meetings in May. Each one was a really good discussion. You can see our partners there in the left-hand corner. First, we started with demographics to learn more about who might need extra support, what kind of barriers they face, and what the existing supports are. And here's what we learned. There are lots of opportunities to partner with the Red Cross and Upper Valley Mend, Lake Wenatchee Fire and Rescue, and the Cascade School District to help prepare the community and also to establish a line of communication with English and Spanish speakers so that we have a good notification system. We know that there are about 20 people already identified as vulnerable persons, according to a program that was started, I think, a couple years ago from the Lake Wenatchee Fire and Rescue. So they already have a program that checks in on those folks. We also have identified about 10 people who qualify for the Medical Electrical Needs Registry. Those are folks who depend on medical equipment who depend on electricity for their medical equipment. The most common need is oxygen. And then we also learned that less than 5% speak Spanish in this area, but we can partner with MEND and schools for outreach as they're kind of the community hubs for that population. We had a good discussion about community care centers, which, if you remember, is a place where people can go to charge their phones and get air conditioning and food and water. And we found out that less than 10% of the population would likely use it. Red Cross recommends, just as a matter of best practice, that people stay in their homes during a power outage. And just based on these conversations, it sounds like the community would be better served if we just worked with the existing community service organizations in that area to provide support. Any questions? Okay, hearing none, we're going to move on to Tika Sellers talking about neighborhood water supplies.
Good morning, Commissioners. Tika Sellers, Customer Outreach Specialist. And one of the subcommittees that I'm working on is what we're calling our neighborhood water supply. So this includes residential water, and we're also talking with our own wastewater group. We're having a meeting tomorrow to understand some of the impacts to the wastewater facility. So overall, we've been getting great feedback. The outreach was done here by phone call, so we didn't actually bring a meeting together, but we are learning about those systems, who the right contacts are, how we can communicate with them leading up to an event, what the capacity of their system is, just kind of taking inventory of all of those systems. And then Cody Gillen, who's part of our team, will be creating a GIS layer so that we have all of that information readily available when we need it. One nice thing that we're learning from these water purveyors, who have all been very supportive of the effort, is that they communicate with their own members quite regularly, whether it be via email, phone tree, reader boards, things like that. So we'll be able to utilize their communication channels leading up to, during, and after an event. So that's been great to learn. In terms of our wastewater facility, we are going to be talking with our own internal folks tomorrow about the impact. So for instance, if a water system continues to use water at the regular rate during an outage because maybe they have backup generation and they filled their reservoirs, what does that impact have on our wastewater facility? And would there be concern that it could possibly overflow if too many people are using their water systems? So we're digging into some of those more details, but we have made contact with all the water purveyors. So any questions on that?
Yes, I have one, Tika.
Hey.
It just hit me when you brought up this slide and started talking about that in the fire areas, the vast majority of people that would be cut out of power have their own domestic water supply, most of them without reservoirs. And so when the power goes off, their water is out. And I noticed that you talked about access to backup power capability, but how deep a dive are you taking on that? Because I got to believe that there's literally hundreds of people that will be without water if their power is off.
So most of the folks in that area are served by one of these water purveyors. That's what we're understanding. There's about 8 to 10 large water purveyors that we've been communicating with, and then there's a handful of smaller ones as well. So I'm believing that the majority of people are actually served off of these systems and not necessarily their individual wells. But you are correct. If their power is out and they don't have backup generation, yes, they would be out of water for that time period.
Don't know what to do about it at the moment, but
right.
It's a factoid. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's what this subcommittee really is trying to dig into, is all trying to learn all of those different impacts. But again, if someone is on a particular water system and that water system continues to be used like normal, what is that impact going to have to the wastewater system? So we're not sure what the messaging is there. Do we ask people to conserve? So we're learning some new things. But I will take note of your comment.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. If no other questions, I have the next two slides as well. So Rebecca, if you'll go to the next slide, please. So economics and logistics, Sean Seaman and I have been reaching out to non-residential customers. So we identified about 30 business owners or public agencies such as the state parks And we've been reaching out to them again by phone. They've all received our postcard as well, but we want to make sure that they know that we care that a power outage could have a great impact on their business. And we want to provide that support, understand what kind of backup capabilities they have if they do. It's kind of a mixed bag on folks who do have backup generation versus not. Some aren't interested in it because the return on investment is not great enough for them. Others have a generator but haven't hooked it up yet. Sean and I are trying to explain to them that they'll need to work with an electrician to get the correct transfer switch so that they're not feeding back onto our system, those sorts of things. And then also understanding how we're going to communicate with those businesses leading up to, during, and after an event. So if we're in a weather watch period, how can we communicate with them to let them know that? Some really aren't interested in going out and finding the information themselves. They feel like we should be pushing that information out to them. So that's a discussion on our team that we need to have. Find out what tools we have available and how we can get organized to be able to do something like that. In terms of this particular group, that's about all I have right now. We're still trying to understand some of the things, but in terms of providing resources, you know, we're not providing generators to these folks. We really don't provide consultation for how to hook up a backup generator. So really just support and understanding with this group and learning and letting them know that they can reach out to us with questions, concerns, those sorts of things. So more to come on this one as well. Any questions before we move on? Okay. Next slide, please. So my last slide here is contingency planning for an active fire. So what we've been calling this is an event within an event or an incident within an incident, which is what we've learned they refer to that in the incident management teams is an incident within an incident. So this would be if we're in a fire weather watch or during a power outage that we have initiated. If a fire breaks out, what are we going to do, right? One of the things that we hear from some of the people that we talk to is, well, if there's a fire going on and you turn off the power to my house, I can't run my water to save my house. And we have to kind of stay in our lane a little bit and say, okay, well, those are two different situations. We're not assuming that a fire is going on when we go to shut the power off. So this is what if a fire does start while the power is out. So for instance, some of the things that we're learning here are there was a fire in that area sometime in the past and fire trucks came over from the west side and they were wanting to fill up their fire tanks with the residential water reservoirs, right? So that took water away from those folks. So that's probably something that we would work with fire officials on to make sure that they know where they can fill up. Also, what's the possibility that we can turn the power back on if that fire weather watch period subsides and that fire weather risk goes away? Could we re-energize? How can we safely re-energize if there's a fire going on somewhere in the area? So that's really what this group is. And Chad Bowman, if there's anything I missed on this slide, please let me know. Any questions on this particular slide? Okay, I'm going to pass along my duties to the next person. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Chad Bowman, Director of Transmission. You've seen this slide during some of our presentations in the past. Again, what we're really trying to do here is establish threshold weather conditions that we can forecast, hopefully 7 to 9 days in the future, that would guide us to determine if and when we need to stand up an incident management team to begin communicating, really, that de-energization is possible. So to that end, we now have a internal fire weather dashboard that monitors these conditions, utilizes three different National Weather Service models, forecasts that are updated every 6 hours. And really, again, the goal or the purpose of this whole program is to prevent a fire that starts from utility infrastructure that would survive initial attack. And the team is really taking a holistic view of weather conditions, wind being the big one, wind coupled with dry fuels, then lead to fires with flame lengths that are difficult to suppress. So that's one of the differences you'll see here is we're using actual flame length because that's easier to get your arms around rather than burn index that we talked about last time. In terms of frequency and duration of occurrences, like I mentioned last time, the risk, even though it is very high in this area, we think it is less than California, really because of lower overall wind speeds. We don't have the sustained Santa Ana winds, and we don't have the chaparral like California does, which is a very burnable fuel type. So really, as a result, we think the frequency of occurrence, at least based on historical weather conditions, is maybe somewhere in the 3 to 5 year range. Although the big caveat there is historical weather conditions don't necessarily predict the future. So we'll really see where we end up as we monitor these conditions throughout the summer. Questions?
Right, thanks, Chad. So the next slide, situational awareness. Some interesting developments in the last month. Oregon Public Utility Commission issued some temporary rules for all investor-owned utilities. 50 pages of how to do public safety power shutoffs. Glad to report that this plan meets, I'd say, 99% of those rules. Not that they apply to us necessarily, we're talking about Oregon, but it's good to know that this plan does follow best practices. Other utilities are also taking a stance on their own versions of this fire safety outage plan. BPA will implement their own PSPS policy for their transmission network, including in Washington and Oregon for high-risk areas. Same for Pacific Corp. They have some they identified Yakima as a high-risk area. They don't anticipate they'll have to use a PSPS this year for that area, but that the plan does include that area of Washington. Avista is not implementing a PSPS policy. Instead, they're using things like AI technology to bolster their fire hardening efforts, including surveillance for hazard trees and automatic reclosing. Increasing pole replacement, that sort of thing. Puget Sound Energy, most of their territory is pretty low to moderate risk, so they're just focused on hardening their lines as well. They don't have a PSPS policy. In our own area, Okanagan Electrical Co-op, they adopted their fire safety outage plan in May. And we also had recent editorials in the Seattle Times and Walla Walla Union Bulletin. Both of them applauded the efforts of utilities to create PSPS plans for areas that are high risk. We're going to be giving a presentation, 10-minute presentation in July, July 15th at the WOPUTA meeting. So you'll see Chelan PUD on the agenda in the next month or so, talking about these kinds of plans on a statewide level. Next slide, please. So I'm just going to spend a minute talking about our outreach efforts. Again, commissioners, if you have any questions that come to you from your constituents, you can always rely on chelanpud.org/FSOM as a resource. We have frequently asked questions there. And then below that, you can see a list of different outreach events that we've done in the last month. And I'm happy to report it's going well. I got to say, I'm a bit surprised that I'm encountering majority support at each of these events. And I just want to credit the incredible community service organizations in that area, the Lake Wenatchee Plain area. They've got this culture that's built on service to the community. They look after each other, they're organized, and they have a huge volunteer force, and they've really helped a lot in helping us build trust and credibility as we're letting folks know about this plan in that area. We're still early in this process. I've heard from both Chief Dave Walker in the Lake Wenatchee area and from the auxiliary president that they are encountering neighbors who have not yet heard of the plan. So I do think there is more outreach we need to do in that area, and I'm going to be creating a plan this week that addresses that. The common questions we're seeing is that people want to know, how will I be notified? How long will the power be out? And like I said, we built a frequently asked questions document that addresses a lot of those concerns. And we have a fact sheet in production right now about generator safety and how to install one in your home or business. I mean, not with the technical details, but basically safety considerations and tips on how to operate one safely. So that is a summary of the outreach that I've done, and that concludes our presentation. Do any of you have any overall questions or comments, advice on next steps?
Commissioners, any questions? Good presentation. There's a... you know, that this is such new territory for any of us that it's hard to predict what reactions might be if the power to get shut off at Forest Ridge or Lake Wenatchee or Gary, I had to bring you back into the meeting, Gary. So.
Well, thank you, Randy. And I if I can, I don't mean to interrupt, but I do want to say that because of the remoteness of Forest Ridge, it is really a good example to use, and I've given a great deal of thought and talked with my neighbors too about how they might deal with issues like medical devices that need electricity to run. And I'm so pleased to hear that our staff has already looked around the corner and given thought to those types of issues in the planning process. So that gives me a great deal of comfort, and it also helps me to then have conversations with my neighbors to put their fears to rest. So thank you. Good job.
Commissioners, this is a good chance just to say, you know, we had to make a choice earlier this spring. We saw the amount of work, and you can see how much outreach this takes, whether we were going to do this all the way across the county or in a limited geographic area. And we felt like we just couldn't do it for the whole county, so we focused in this Lake Wenatchee Plain area. That doesn't mean we don't still have the ability to put in place a public safety power shutoff, or as we call it, fire safety outage management, in other places like Chelan or Forest Ridge if we were confronted with those situations. To be honest, we wouldn't be as well prepared there if it happened. But if we face that liability risk, we still may have to take that action. So I'll be honest, we've rolled the dice, or I'll say I rolled the dice, in terms of we're going to focus on the place that has the greatest fire risk this year and plan to expand the program to other parts of the county in later years.
You know, I will add that in the Coffee with Bob presentations, there's two of them, one with Leavenworth and one with Plain. In the one with Leavenworth, the number one question was, why don't you have this here? You know, we've got fire risk in Leavenworth. And that's the answer that I gave them, was that it is possible. It's a remote possibility, but like, we're focusing on Lake Wenatchee for the 2021 season because of its many risk factors. It's the highest risk area. So I left the door open if we have to expand this. But yeah, the focus is on the highest risk area first. And then in Plain, the Coffee with Bob, their main, it was really fun. It was a lot of fun, actually. A lot of the same folks went to the auxiliary presentation, and I heard a lot of support for more outreach. And in fact, one person invited me to her neighborhood FireWise meeting to take our presentation on the road. So a lot of support for us getting the word out. And I just want to thank you all for your support, too, on the commission.
Beth. Good presentation.
Commissioners, with that, our next agenda item is to talk about a fairly significant contract that will be coming forward to the board at the next board meeting. I'm guessing that it may take longer than 10 minutes to make that presentation. So we have a choice, Commissioner Smith, as to whether to go ahead and get that going recognizing it might take us a little bit beyond noon, or whether you'd prefer to wait and start this at 1 o'clock.
I'm thinking we should go for it. Ann gave me a thumbs up, so I saw Ed nod, so let's go for it.
Okay, great. Recall that about a month ago we brought you a focused discussion regarding working on Powerhouse 2 and particularly the extended correction period or extended warranty language, and we said we'd be back when we were ready to go with the first unit. So here we are. We're back. John Sigerser will be making this presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Good to see you again. Rebecca, if we could go to slide 2, that'd be great. So as Steve mentioned, we are here today to provide you information on the upcoming resolution related to the first unit, Guaranteed Maximum Price Amendment, or GMP Amendment. This would be GMP number 2, associated with the contract with GE. We are finalizing that GE GMP and expect to be back at the next board meeting to request authorization to execute it for an amount not to exceed $66.9 million, really to be spent over the next 3 years or so. This would increase our total contract amount with GE to a not to exceed of $104.3 million. As a result, this is more than we've expected. We would want to increase our 21 capital budget from $18.5 million to around $21 million. And we would also see an increase in our overall project forecast from $324 million to $456 million. Next slide, please. Just a quick timeline of how we got to where we are today. We received proposals from GE and two other design builders in January of 2020. We executed the design build agreement, which is again the overarching agreement with GE in July of 2020. And of course, just recently executed the extended correction period in the long lead guaranteed maximum price amendment just in May of this year. Next slide, please. This is a graphical representation of the timeline for the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 Rehabilitation Project. We're at the star on the far left of the slide, having just executed the extended correction period and preparing to execute the first unit GMP. This means we are, with the execution of the first unit GMP, we're going to be entering the construction phase of the project. We are starting manufacturing of the long lead components. The first unit GMP will authorize manufacturing of additional components, as well as all the site work and rehabilitation of the components we plan to reuse. Therefore, following the request to authorize execution of the first unit GMP, the next board action would be for changes to that GMP or request to authorize other GMPs, such as for the second unit. Next slide, please. This is a slide you should have seen before. It represents one of the main reasons why we're using the design build contracting methodology. The design build methodology allows us to progress the design to a point where we have greater cost certainty when we begin the work. This is actually one of our stated project goals, predictable cost and schedule, and this process should help us achieve exactly that. Next slide, please. So guaranteed maximum price amendment number 2 is for the rehabilitation of the first unit, which will most likely be unit U5. The contractual dates included would have the rehab outage starting on September 9th of 2022 and reach substantial completion on May 30th of 2024. It is important to note that this contract requires completion of a trial operation period prior to substantial completion. So rehabilitation and commissioning of the unit would be completed at least 150 days prior to the May 30th date listed here. There are liquidated damages and incentives associated with these contractual dates. as well as associated with the trial operation period forced outage rate and generator losses. Similar to the long lead GMP, this GMP includes protection from foreign exchange rate fluctuation and a 4% design build contingency. It also includes an allowance for raw material price escalation. So again, unique to design build, allowances increase or decrease the amount of the GMP automatically based on what the actual expense was, while contingency is shared with GE at the end of the contract. Next slide, please. This is a typical cost breakdown for unit rehabilitation projects and shows what constitutes the $66.9 million of the first unit GMP and how those costs are broken out. Next slide, please. This slide is another cost breakdown, which really gives us the costs authorized to date, including the extended correction period executed last month, and the addition of the $66.9 million for the first unit GMP, and what makes up the $104.3 million for the not to exceed amount. Next slide, please. The first unit GMP is expected to be more expensive than those of the subsequent unit GMPs. This slide shows some of the one-time cost and other differences that we expect between the first unit and subsequent unit GMPs. As you can see at the bottom, we expect subsequent unit GMPs to be closer to the $28 million range. Next slide, please. This slide shows the increases in costs or costs not included in the original project forecast that make up the difference between the $324 million forecast and the proposed $456 million forecast. The first line, piping inside and outside the bulb, is the biggest change in the forecast. The piping really connects the governor high pressure units, or HPUs, to the turbine blades and wicket gate servos to control the unit speed, efficiency, megawatt output. Due to the configuration of the bulb units in the plant layout, the HPUs are not located near the servos, requiring extensive piping to connect the two. This has always been included in the scope of work, but was not included in GE's proposal in January of 2020. The extent of the scope and cost was discovered during the pre-construction phase. Scope includes replacing all piping inside the bulb due to the heat and vibration the pipe has experienced and been exposed to over the last 40 years. It also includes replacing all piping 4 inches and smaller outside of the bulb. Piping that is over 4 inches would be refurbished. The scope is in line with our goal of achieving a 40-year service life for all components associated with the units. The next line item, value optimization, is the changes in design features coming from the collaborative design process that helps improve the quality, safety, operation, and overall maintenance of the units. This includes, but is not limited to, cost changes due to manufacturing location, material type, tie-offs, lifting lugs, and other features to promote safety during future maintenance, relocating equipment outside of confined spaces where possible, and other such design considerations. One factor in significantly impacting both the piping costs and the value optimization is the cost of raw materials. Raw material prices have almost increased an average of 68% since the original forecast. The prices for copper have increased 77%, carbon steel 102%, and stainless steel 45% since the original forecast, with most of that increasing occurring since December of 2020. This impacted the cost of the long lead GMP by approximately 30% and is impacting not only the cost of the first unit GMP, but also of the overall project forecast. The next line, for site work covers all the cost increases associated with preparing the site for work, as well as the disassembly and reassembly of the unit and rehabilitation of all the reused components. This includes two new temporary buildings to stack, wind, or rewind the generators on site and assemble the turbine and turbine distributor on site. These units were last disassembled in the 1980s with very different safety expectations. Working at heights and under live loads was commonplace at the time, but unthinkable really today. Therefore, these costs include the development of new special tools to accomplish the work in accordance with modern safety standards, as well as refurbishment or replacement of all the original special tools. The next line for the design build fee. The design build fee is a percentage increase to cover the design builder's overhead and profit. In GE's case, the design build fee is 33.34%. So as the cost of the work increases, the cost of materials increase, so does the design build fee. The design build fee includes GE's profit, which is 8.05%, as well as other overhead costs, such as their administrative staff, office operations and support, home office and facilities, management, financing costs, and other taxes other than the Washington State sales tax and other local taxes. Costs associated with the extended correction period were also not included in the original project forecast. Our stated project goal is guaranteed service life and warranty. So while the concept has always been a part of the project, the financial costs and benefits were not known until recently. The next line, district contingency, which is different than the design build contingency listed above, is held and managed solely by the district to cover project risk. Contingency is a typical part of rehabilitation project budget and was included in the original project forecast. This represents the increase in current level of district contingency for this project. The contingency was established to cover risks. In summary, we're anticipating approximately $132 million increase in the overall project forecast from $324 million to $456 million. Next slide, please. We revisited the project economic analysis in light of these anticipated increases in the overall project cost. The revised economic analysis performed by Kurt Carlson used a range of potential project costs ranging from $457 million to $665 million. These are in nominal dollars, so they include inflation. And the revised analysis also used the current forward price curve from energy planning and trading. The result showed an internal rate of return ranging from 18.8% to 14.6%, depending on the anticipated overall project costs. Another analysis was performed using just a flat energy rate of $30 a megawatt hour, and that analysis yielded an internal rate of return of 12.8% for an anticipated overall project cost of $665 million. Just as a point of reference, the economic analysis associated with the original project forecast in October of 2017 had an internal rate of return of 16.2% for an anticipated overall project cost of $352 million. Of course, all of these numbers listed here are in nominal dollars as well. Next slide, please. So, next steps, as mentioned, we plan to return at the next board meeting where we'll be presenting a resolution requesting authorization to execute GMP number 2 for the first unit rehabilitation, adding $66.9 million to contract 1810 with GE. The resolution will also include a request to increase the 2021 capital budget associated with the contract to $21 million. Once approved, we'll also request authorization to change the official overall project forecast to $456 million. This concludes my planned presentation. Are there any questions at this time?
Commissioners, questions?
So, John, you'd mentioned foreign exchange fluctuation. And did I hear that correctly? That there was a contingency in there?
There's a protection. So GE protects us from foreign exchange fluctuations as part of this guaranteed maximum price. So as the foreign exchange rate, again, manufacturing parts in Brazil, Italy, Turkey, Canada, and as those foreign exchange rates fluctuate, they will hold their price steady for us. So they're taking that risk as part of this.
And then between the first unit and the second unit, am I understanding, or maybe I don't understand, the difference between that price? It appears that it's dropping.
That
is correct. The first one is more, and then remind me why that is. Why is that first one so much more expensive?
The first one's more expensive. Well, number one, it's always more expensive to do the first one because it bears the brunt of a lot of the design costs and development of the site procedures and things along those lines. It also has mobilization and the site preparation charges, which we listed as kind of the one-time expenses, building the new buildings that are necessary. Refurbishing all of our existing special tools, developing new special tools, things along those lines. It's also worth noting the planned outage for the first unit is expected to be about 16 months. And the subsequent unit outages are going to drop to about 12 months each. So, you know, at almost more than $500,000 a month on site, that's pretty substantial in and of itself.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Additional questions? So, John, go ahead, Gary. Go ahead.
Sorry, Randy. I just wanted to ask John whether or not we've whether there's any kind of a provision for Bitcoin in this. I mean, Elon Musk is taking it for his Tesla, so come on.
That's up to you guys. We'll do whatever you want.
John, his question is actually better than mine because mine is totally off the wall. These are not the turbines, or are they, that have the ironwood bearings?
No, these do not have ironwood bearings. So these have the traditional babbitted bearings. It's a four-bearing system. It has a turbine bearing, turbine guide bearing, intermediate guide bearing, a generator guide bearing, and then thrust and counter thrust bearings, with kind of the traditional babbitted surface.
Yeah. Ever since I heard that we had these ironwood bearings many, many years ago, I've just been thoroughly fascinated by them.
Yeah.
I don't know if we ultimately have ended up reusing any of them in our rebuilds or not. But.
Yep.
Any other questions? Thank you. Good update.
Thank you.
Good update. It's getting expensive.
It is. So thank you for your time. We'll see you in July.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Steve, anything more for this morning?
Nope. That's what we had for you.
Okay. Why don't we recess and reconvene at 1:00?
Sounds good.
Good afternoon and welcome to the afternoon session of the June 14th, 2021 PUD, Chelan PUD Commission. This morning we met in a study session. This afternoon is our business session. And we will continue our business session with the first item on the agenda, which is our consent agenda. The consent agenda was modified this morning to include agenda item number 12. So I would solicit a motion to approve the consent agenda, which now includes resolution 12.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the consent agenda as presented with the addition of item 12.
Is there a second?
I would second.
It's been moved and seconded. Moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Opposed? None. Okay, thank you. Now we're on to regular agenda item number 11.
This is a resolution declaring Total Resource Management Incorporated of Alexandria, Virginia as the sole source supplier of Total Resource Management Maximo Prime subscription for an integrated solution of Rules Manager SE and annual support and maintenance of the Maximo software suite. I believe we've got Nicole Villacrez and Ben Field online, and they've got a presentation that'll be coming up here too. Looks like it's online there too. So turn it over to Nicole and Ben.
Great. Hi, everybody. We have this resolution here. This is for our annual support and maintenance of the Maximo system. And the request, we understand that there was a question about the kind of lump sum that we are asking for here, and we can go ahead and move forward. We are asking for 3 years worth of support costs. We are not actually entering into a three-year agreement with Total Resource Management. We're looking to reduce the need for annual resolutions, actually. The Total Resource Management, we have to do a sole source with them in order to pay our annual support and maintenance. We pay it annually. It's not a long-term contract, but the Maximo Prime subscription with them for the support is a sole source because they include their proprietary software called Rules Manager, which enables us to do a lot of specialized customizations in Maximo. So that is why we come to you with the sole source resolution to do our annual support and maintenance renewal each year. We did one last year, we're doing this one this year. And we thought it would save administrative overhead and cost to not have to do the resolution every year if we could get approval from you to just kind of approve the 3 years worth of support costs ahead of time. We kind of broke it out for you on the next slide. Over the 3 years, this is how that 800K breaks out. And we're estimating that we will use Total Resource Management for this year and then two more years. The Maximo Prime support for this year is coming in at about 214K. We think we will be implementing Mobile Maximo, which is adding a little bit of cost, some more costs each year. We may not implement that this year, but we wanted to have the cost in there just in case. So pretty much these are really estimates for 2022 and 2023. You can see that the cost does go up quite a bit in 2023, but there's the potential that we may move to the cloud in that year with Maximo. And that could increase the cost. We're estimating probably around 30% for our support and maintenance. But if we do move to the cloud, that cost will be offset by a reduction in IT operations costs that the staff spends managing on-premise Maximo. So that is the breakout, again, of the $833,000 we're asking approval of for our support for this year and the following 2 years. And again, the idea is just saving having to come to you every year for our sole source approval.
Questions? Ann?
Yeah, thank you. So thanks, Nicole, for presenting that and for breaking that down.
So I totally understand you're wanting to present us with a three-year, a three-year renewal versus having to come back every year. That makes sense. It just seems like, a 30% jump is really, that just seems really huge to me. Why is the cost so great to go to the cloud?
It is an estimate at this time, and we're not sure we're actually going to do it that year. Ben, do you have an idea where that estimate came in at 30%? Is that super rough?
Hi. Yes, it is rough. It's around 30%, and that is a number that came from IBM in response to the question of what kind of cost increase could we see when we choose to switch to the cloud service. We're wanting to be conservative and upfront about something, a potential cost increase. And like Nicole said, that should be offset by a reduction in staff costs internally. And the reason for that is that with cloud hosting, the vendors provides a lot more of the server and core software management. And so we believe that the reason for the cost increase has to do with their increased role in administering software.
So Ben, so the offset, so would we be talking about a reduction in staff and say one, you probably can't say, but is that what you're talking about if it's offset by our internal costs?
I don't know that Ian could probably speak to whether there would be a hard reduction in staff numbers. I'm doubting it, more just like a redistribution of effort.
Yeah. Hi, Commissioner. So what you'll see when we move to the cloud is that it's no longer just a cost to use the software anymore. You're moving the software into a cloud infrastructure that requires servers, networking, staff time on the cloud provider to upgrade software, upgrade those underground foundational technologies. And so there's an increased cost when you do that. But by also moving into the cloud, also moving the cloud, what you will see from the operations side is that we actually have a contractor right now who we paid to upgrade our software and maintain this product. We also have costs on our servers and our networks and people maintaining them. Some costs on using energy to manage and actually run this product. And so those costs would be shifted to the cloud. And so it's not necessarily a staff reduction. It would be sometimes maybe a staff reduction supporting it, but moving those staff to a different opportunity cost internally. Some of the things that you're seeing is an increase in different applications that IT is running that we have to shift those staff to. But there is a definitely reduction in foundational maintenance and moving that maintenance to the cloud. Does that make sense?
It does. Sounds like you guys have really analyzed it. And well, of course you have. I trust that you guys do. It just seemed like a huge jump to me. And just glad to hear you guys are doing the analysis and if it's like an outside contractor, if we can save those costs, I hated to see us jump to the cloud and then have a reduction in our staff, a shift that way. So anyway, thank you. That makes more sense to me.
Okay, thank you.
A question that I would have is, help me understand what Mobile Maximo is.
I can speak to that. Maximo is a software application that currently you run on your desktop computer in a web browser. And when someone is outside of the office, say in their vehicle or at a job site where they don't have a desktop computer, very often that's actually where they need the information that's in Maximo.
Okay.
And so Mobile Maximo licenses allow us to run a different kind of Maximo server and client software that runs on phones and tablets.
Okay. I suppose that's what it was. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't guessing wrong. So thank you very much for that clarification.
Yes.
Any other questions?
Randy, and again, just thank you guys for, you know, I had asked to get a little bit more information on this. So thanks for jumping in and preparing this at the last minute.
Always.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Nicole.
Really glad to help.
Okay, thank you, Nicole and Benjamin. We need to take action on this resolution as it's our only resolution before us. Is there a motion to approve Resolution 11?
So moved.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded to approve Resolution 11. Is there any discussion?
Randy, Randy.
Go ahead.
Because of the uncertainty as we head into the third year, even though we're making the motion and voting on it, I think it would be nice to just have a report back to us on the specifics as we get farther down the road.
Absolutely. This is Nicole again. We can 100% keep you informed on that. And I wanted to add, we absolutely don't have to spend up to that limit. We can spend much less than that as time goes on. We want to each year evaluate and make sure that the subscription with Total Resource Management is still serving the district's needs appropriately.
Thank you.
Any other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is carried. We're on to manager items.
We have four today. I want to start with a COVID-19 update. Carrie Wendell will give that report. Oops, looks like Lindsay's on.
She's on mute. There you go.
I fixed it. Good afternoon, commissioners. This is Lindsay Mons, business manager in customer utilities, and I will be taking this on today, giving you a different presenter each month to keep you on your toes. So for May 2021 through the end of the month, our customer outreach continues to be strong, sending out those notices to customers who could be impacted in the future with collection efforts. Our door hangers continue to be successful at about 50%. I would note that we had seven commercial door hangers this month and received payment from all of those. So those were very successful approach. With those commercial customers that we've been unable to reach otherwise so far. On the customer past due accounts, we have been successful this month. We've dropped under 400, which is a big success for this, or slightly under. We're at 399. As a reminder, these are those customers who have accounts that are past due more than 55 days and have not made a substantial payment within that time period as well. So we do continue to have accounts beyond 60 days, which you'll see on the next slide, but these are specific to those customers who aren't making active efforts to bring them current. With our retail revenue and past due status, we do continue to see our residential balance continue to grow. It increased about $30,000 again this month, which, while it looks alarming, I would say is probably not alarming just yet. If you look at the 2019 numbers in blue, this is a very normal trend for this time of year. Next month or in July, if it doesn't start turning around, then I will start to get a little more worried. When we start seeing those, we should start seeing those come down a bit. These balances would be much higher, you know, if it wasn't for those Helping Hands and EAP payments, which we continue to receive from our Community Action Council partner. So Rebecca, on our next slide is our Helping Hands, which is a district customer-funded program, as well as the commission-funded, with their contribution late last year. We saw 12 customers help there, a little over $4,000. This is really the filling the gap funding. So EAP funds pick up the first amount, and then anyone that doesn't qualify for EAP but meets the threshold, we fill in with this Helping Hands fund. This fund so far, well, since March 2020, since the beginning of COVID, really the customer contributions and the disbursements have been fairly equal. So we see that balance remaining around $125,000, which is a good balance. And I'll touch on that again in a couple slides here. So I just wanted to mention it here while we were on the slide that we do have a healthy balance in our Helping Hands fund. For EAP distributions, we had a good month again. So about $45,000 on the next slide, Rebecca, in EAP distributions. That's the Energy Assistance Program for low-income customers. 94 customers were helped. They're just short of $500 per customer on average. So that's the basics of our normal presentation. I'll pause here if you have any questions before I touch on kind of a special topic. Okay, so last month, we promised to come back to you this month with our plans associated with the expiration of the governor's moratorium. We were hopeful that there would be more certainty by now, but there really haven't been any decisions at the state level as of now. So just an update on the governor's proclamation 20.23, which is the proclamation that put a pause on any disconnection of customers for non-payment, as well as any late fees. This proclamation is set to expire at the end of July, or when the emergency state is lifted, whichever comes first, and as may be extended. So we haven't seen a decision from the governor's office either way, as far as if it would be extended or if it would expire sooner or on the 31st. However, utilities are working together through the Department of Commerce as well, looking at plans for post-expiration customer interactions. So what would we do? What outreach would we perform? And how would we communicate with these customers that have past due accounts through this time? Some of the tools that have been proposed through that to avoid disconnection of those customers would be multiple contact attempts with a period of time in between. So continued outreach, which we have started with our customers already, working with them to inform them of the situation, as well as developing long-term payment plans. Proposals have been in the range of 6 months to 18 months. We're really not sure what the governor's office would propose there, but we are working on what we might propose internally in lieu of any direction from the governor's office. Other tools being continued fee deferral. So we're currently not paying or charging late fees nor disconnect or reconnect fees if we were to be doing that activity. However, this would propose for those customers on payment arrangements or who have expressed need to us that we would continue things like that. And then there's other optional support programs. So a lot of the utilities that we've heard from are IOUs or investor-owned utilities, which do have a little more flexibility in their ability to use retail revenues to support past due accounts and things. Some of them have set aside a 1% of retail revenues to support payment of these. But in this situation, we have an opportunity with our Helping Hands Fund, which, as I noted, is a very healthy balance, to provide additional support for those customers who would qualify. Some of the programs that other utilities are using these funds for are things like paying balances for customers who have received EAP funds in the past. So in the past 2 years, you know, the customers that we know are low income, we could make a fair assessment or assumption that they probably haven't changed their situation much, and those utilities are looking to pay off balances for those type of customers. So those are all the types of things we're currently looking at or considering as we develop a plan. And we do plan to come back to you in July with some more details and options for you as to what that plan might look like, whether or not there's any decision at the governor's office level. So if there are any questions or things you'd like us to take a look at as we develop that plan, we'd love to know.
Commissioners, any questions? Thank you, Lindsay. It's, you know, from the stories we've heard around the state, our customers have been, as we know them to be, better than average. We've got a great customer base. So
we certainly do.
No other questions?
You. I just want to thank Lindsay for doing the presentation today. Thank you, Lindsay. Good information. And something that I really like to keep my finger on the pulse of. So appreciate it very much.
We'll see you next month.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, Commissioners, Ron Slaball is going to give an update on the regional water meeting and capital budget.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Been to you several times an update on regional water since we began searching for a second source back almost 7 years ago. I think we started that in 2014. And efforts to date have primarily been focused on looking for a high quality, robust source on Chelan County side. We've been looking at groundwater wells, and we just haven't been successful. One of the options that was evaluated in the initial report back in 2014 that could provide high capacity, high quality water supply in Chelan County surface water plant, withdrawing water directly from the Columbia River, treating it, pumping it into the regional distribution system. It's something that we haven't looked at thus far because it is a pretty costly alternative, both in terms of capital and operations and maintenance costs. But we did think that it'd be worthwhile to at least have more accurate information about that or alternative to inform regional's decision making. And to that end, we teamed with the Chelan Douglas Regional Port Authority and were successful in receiving some grant funding through the state's capital budget to perform that treatability and feasibility study. So specifically, we'll look for a piece of property somewhere down between South Wenatchee and Malaga. We could perform some pilot testing of various technologies, determine what's suitable for treating surface water. We could use design criteria from those studies to put together some cost estimates, both capital and O&M, to better understand the cost associated with that particular alternative. The PUD, in talking with the regional members, has offered, and they've graciously accepted, that we would go ahead and manage that particular effort. We'll primarily be through our engineering project management group to select a consulting firm that would then come in and perform that scope. Probably be something that will occur within the next 18 to 24 months. We still have to understand the funding requirements and, of course, get that finalized through the state. Questions, comments, concerns with this?
Just a comment, Ron. Way to be proactive.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Interesting that you know, the Chelan Douglas Regional Port Authority, that the fact that they are now jointly operating, any thoughts on, did that have a positive impact on the outcome of the grant request?
I don't, Commissioner Smith. Putting in those applications all happened so quickly that we heard through the state that some dollars could be made available, and there was a handful of requests that we and other local jurisdictions made, and several of them, I don't know if they were all successful, but certainly several of them were, but I'm not familiar with the decision process at the state and how they were able to allocate those funds.
Okay, thank you. Well, thanks for the update.
Welcome.
Okay, next up, Janelle Ulrich would like to talk about the Rock Island Relicensing Outreach Program.
Here we go. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes. Okay.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Janelle Ulrich, Hydro Licensing Manager. Well, Rock Island Relicensing Outreach is moving into full swing. We've completed one-on-one preliminary outreach meetings with each of a total of 10 tribes, state, and federal agencies. We are embarking on some congressional outreach this summer to make delegates aware of the impending relicensing process. And we are about to host 3 public outreach events in late June and early July. These include attending a booth at Pybus Market during the Saturday market to share flyers and announce an upcoming virtual meeting, as well as the beginning of the relicensing process in the fall. We will also be conducting a virtual information meeting. CTC will be hosting that on July 8th. And we're working to figure out the most effective way to reach out to our Latinx community, either in with the Wenatchee Cafe, which is kind of a walk-through and drive-through on the south end of town where we could have a booth, or at the 4th of July celebration down at the Walla Walla Park. Mario Cantu is helping us ascertain what's the most effective thing there. There are going to be some opportunities to solicit input from various and sundry stakeholders coming up. The first of which is we've put together a high-level overview of the Rock Island project. We call it an initial consultation document, or because you have to have initials for everything, an ICD. That's going to go out on June 21st to all folks that are on our mailing lists, including all of those agency and tribal people that we met with earlier. And a lot of the NGOs and other members in our community who are in our mailing lists and anyone else who is interested that we learn about from the other outreach events. We also have an online survey that will be going out inviting people to be added to our mailing lists, tell us how they would like to participate in the process, either to gain information or to attend meetings, and to share their interests and concerns. And that is slated to go out on July 6th for a 30-day period. And the final thing we're doing for outreach is we are building and improving our relicensing website. It's going to provide links that makes it possible for people to join mailing lists, to learn about upcoming events and meetings, to access various documents and to provide comments in an internet tool, and also to learn about the Rock Island Project and its various attributes through links to other parts of our website. So we just wanted to make sure that all of you commissioners are up to speed with what we're doing for outreach and give you the opportunity to ask any questions you may have.
Commissioners, any questions? It just seems like yesterday this process was only 20 years away.
It's true.
Janelle, I'd just like to compliment you and your team on trying to think around all the corners and pull this together. It's a big undertaking. And boy, am I ever happy that you're at the helm on this thing and kind of keeping an eye out for the things that might be heading our way. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Arsenault. Thank you. We will.
Hey. Any other questions for Janelle? Thanks a lot. We appreciate the update. We will expect to see a lot of you in the next few years.
Might be the case. Take care.
One more item, Commissioners. We want to do a correction for the record, which will probably unfurl Commissioner Smith's brow. So Rachel Hansen will do that.
Hi there, Commissioners. I just wanted to correct the record. Commissioner Smith asked a question about how many of the customers in the Phase 1 area for fire safety outages are served by these neighborhood water systems. And over the lunch break, I double-checked that statistic. It's more like 40% of the customers in that Phase 1 area are served by shared water systems. So that means the rest of everyone up there, about 60%, are on individual wells.
Thank you. That sounds way more like what I thought it would.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Okay, and that's what we have for you.
Ready? Hey, Steve. This is John Stoll. Ron was going to do an update on Peshaskin Water District as well.
Oh, okay.
Skip that.
All right. Sorry about that. Go for it, Ron.
Okay. Thank you. Well, commissioners, you're also aware the Peshawson Water District a number of years ago requested that we take over their ownership and operations of their system. We recently completed financial analysis and determined that there would be some impact due primarily to some capital improvements that we required on that system if we were to take it over. So a couple of the barriers to us, or the primary barrier to us taking that system over would just be the cost of those improvements and not wanting to carry those costs over to our customers. Well, the Peshawson Water District applied for and also received about $1.1 million from the state to fund a large part of their capital improvement plan, primarily a new drinking water well that they need. They have also applied for some dollars through Chelan County. Haven't heard the outcome of that yet. And we, on their behalf, applied for some federal money for the remainder of their capital improvement plan. So a lot of the financial barrier has been removed. And also remind you that Peshawson Water District has completed quite a bit of customer outreach. There was 3 in-person public meetings in 2019, and they completed 2 virtual meetings earlier this year. And overall, they've had pretty strong customer support for turning their system over to the PUD. So at this point, it would be our recommendation to move forward with the development of a plan and some action items for what it would take to take over that Peshawson Water District system. I haven't been involved with one of these yet. There's going to be a bit to learn from it. I have reached out to Thurston PUD and to Kitsap, our member PUDs that have been involved with several of these acquisitions, to learn some from them. Of course, for the most part, it's a transfer of assets, property, debts, various obligations and such, getting the billing system set up. There is a fair amount to do, and we'll be putting that plan together, and we'll come back to the board with regular check-ins and to request your feedback along the way. Any questions or comments about Peshawson Water District?
None here, other than I'm thrilled that they were successful at the state level for the people of Peshawson. To have that reliable source of water is going to be a big thing going forward. Commissioners, any other questions or comments of Ron? Okay.
Okay. Thank you much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks for the update.
Steve, you said that was all your manager items?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, next item is commissioner items. Do we have any commissioner items today? Wow. Follow up on delegation of action items from the previous board meeting.
Sorry, I couldn't unmute fast enough.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'll pause more next time. Lesson learned here.
No, my fault. I couldn't find a button. I just wanted to share with my fellow commissioners kind of a new energy that I found recently when last week I visited Grand Coulee Dam. And just awe-inspiring, certainly the history of the construction of Grand Coulee Dam, the timing of completion couldn't have been better. And so I would suggest to any of my fellow commissioners who might find themselves with their gas tank running a little bit low on public power and hydropower in general, might be worth on a sunny day hopping in the car and running up to Grand Coulee Dam and just go to the visitor center and hear the story once again. And it will get that blood pumping in your veins for what it is that we all do. And how important it really truly is. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. That was good. Very good. Even you got Homer Bone up there nodding yes. So that's right, Dennis? Okay, so back to follow-up. Steve?
There were no delegated action items from the last meeting, so we do not have any.
Okay. Delegation of action items.
We have two that are kind of long-term dated. One is the request to come back with respect to the UW or NOAA ocean condition studies, and I'd probably add the David Welch's study as well, that is going before the regional, what's called the Independent Science Advisory Board. So if there are updates to that, we would bring those back to the board. And then with respect to the contract, the Maximo contract that we just discussed, to bring that back if and when there is a decision to proceed with the cloud-based service, the increased cost service.
Okay. That's it on the delegation?
Yep.
Is there any additional public comment? Are there any other matters to come before the commission before we go into executive session? Hearing none, then we will move into executive session for approximately 90 minutes, could be shorter, but maybe 90 minutes, to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, to evaluate the qualifications of an applicant for public employment and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by the RCW. So unless commissioners need a break, we'll move right into, let's take a 5-minute break because we have to close out, 5 minutes, close out and sign back in on the number that was given to us by Rebecca.
Yeah, let me ask, Rebecca, is that on our calendar or on email?
It's on your calendar, and I just updated it, the timing of it.
Oh, you're awesome. Thank you.
We're coming out of executive session. We find ourselves in need of an additional 30 minutes in executive session, so we will go right back in for another 30 minutes. This is Chelan County Board of PUD Commissioners coming out of executive session. We've been in executive session for approximately 2 hours, coming out at 3:45. No votes were taken, no decisions were made. Is there any additional business that needs to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.